When you think about tyrants, you think about Ho Chi Minh, Robert Mugabe, and Putin. Welcome to their club.
The state house is fractured over budget and spending disagreements with a potential government shutdown less than 2 weeks away. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists finally have monitoring equipment near a restless Alaska volcano.
With these two instruments that are much closer, we'll be able to detect and understand and study the eruption in much more detail.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Early Honors Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers an experiential, individualized, and transformational education to high school seniors across Alaska. Find out more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
On July 1st, Alaska's state government will shut down unless lawmakers can reach an agreement on a budget. Two groups that may be difficult to bring together are the majority and minority caucuses in the House. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
House Minority Republicans say they were blindsided by the majority's late push to pass a combined operating and capital budget ahead of the end of the first special session last week, and it led some lawmakers to denounce the majority, including Eagle River Representative Dan Sadler. He said the fast introduction of the 89-page budget amendment and the 2-minute limit on each House member's comments were a travesty comparable to the attack by Imperial Japan on Pearl Harbor, which brought the United States into World War II.
FDR once said that December 7th, 1941, a day which will live in infamy, will be nowhere near June 15th, 2017, in the annals of infamy.
Anchorage Democratic Representative Chris Tuck said on Friday that Sadler's comments were misplaced.
There's 2,400 Americans that died in that, on that one day. And to compare something as traumatic as that in Americans' history is really over the top.
Anchorage Republican Representative Lance Pruitt also condemned Dillingham Democratic House Speaker Bryce Edgman. Pruitt said the minority didn't have time to read the proposed budget.
When you think about tyrants, you think about Ho Chi Minh, Robert Mugabe, and Putin. Welcome to their club.
Edgman said the majority had a sense of urgency to pass a budget to give the Senate enough time to decide whether to pass it ahead of the end of the first special session. The Senate majority adjourned without discussing the bill.
I'll tell you, when I was a staffer here in the 90s, I heard a lot worse, you know, back before social media and gavel to gavel and this, that, and the other. And so, I think it's all in a day's good work, and, you know, it is what it is.
Criticism of the mostly Democratic House majority spilled over into the Senate. Wasilla Republican Senator David Wilson compared the House majority's handling of the legislation to the laws that enforced racial segregation in the South until 1965.
And it only reminds me of issues that I can only describe for I feel for the other side as a separate but not quite equal and given that. And it just reminds me of those people in power that's supposed to be a party of inclusion and a party of bringing people together is only seen as best described as a party that just wants to support Jim Crow laws in the state of Alaska.
Anchorage Democratic Senator Berta Gardner condemned Wilson's likening procedural decisions to racism.
There was an allusion to supporting the Jim Crow laws, and I think that's completely out of line, and I want to refute that.
Whether hard feelings over the House majority's handling of the end of the first special session make a difference in the second special session remains to be seen. The House minority could still exert influence if any budget agreement between the House and Senate relies on drawing money from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Tapping this reserve account requires support from 3/4 of the House, or at least 8 of the 18 House minority members. The other option is to draw money from permanent fund earnings to pay for the operating budget, which has never been done in the fund's history. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is reshuffling several senior government positions, and it could affect Arctic policies in Alaska. The Washington Post reports dozens of career officials received reassignment letters last Thursday. Alaska's Energy Desk was able to confirm that Joel Clement, a climate policy advisor, received one of those letters. Clement helped advise former President Barack Obama on Arctic issues. In 2011, Clement was appointed to an interagency task force to look at energy development in the Arctic and climate impacts. He authorized a report detailing the effects of warming in the region, such as sea ice loss and melting permafrost. Now Clement has been reassigned to the Office of Natural Resources and Revenue, which collects oil and gas royalties, among other things. In April, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to expand offshore oil and gas drilling in the Arctic. Zinke ordered new studies of the area's resource potential in May. Alaska's Department of Natural Resources is still searching for the black bear that killed 16-year-old Patrick Cooper on Sunday. Meanwhile, another bear attack has claimed the life of a worker and injured another in a gold mine near Delta. In Anchorage, Cooper encountered a bear during the Robert Spur Memorial Hill Climb on the Bird Ridge Trail inside Chugach National State Park. After a search of the trail, Cooper was found pinned to the ground by a black bear. The bear ran away after a park ranger shot it. According to Ken Marsh of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the last fatal bear mauling in Anchorage occurred in 1995.
In this situation, this is a very, very rare occurrence. This appears to be a predatory attack. This is a situation where a bear may not have been surprised, where in fact a bear actually targeted an individual.
Two Fish and Game officers and one park ranger tracked the bear into Monday afternoon. After an initial ground search, trackers found traces of blood from the bear and believe it has moved deeper into the mountains. Marsh says if the bear is found alive, it will be put down. Matt Wedeking from Alaska State Park says investigators are trying to gather information at this point. He says if the Department of Fish and Game is able to recover the bear carcass, it will perform a necropsy to determine if there was anything wrong with the bear. He reminds Alaskans to stay safe on the trails.
Traveling groups make a lot of noise, carry bear spray and or an air horn. Bear incidents happen everywhere in Chugach State Park and any of the state parks, so be aware and plan for it.
Wedeking says the Bird Ridge Trail can reopen if the bear is found. Another fatal bear attack happened early this morning at the Pogo Mine, 38 miles from Delta Junction. Employees were taking geological samples several miles from camp when the bear attacked. The bear was shot and killed after Alaska wildlife troopers directed the mine to have it dispatched. A fire on the Kenai Peninsula has grown to more than 1,300 acres. The East Fork Fire, which was sparked Thursday by dry lightning on the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge near Sterling, has grown from an initial approximately 200 acres to about 1,300 as of Saturday evening, the last time the fire size was updated by officials. Firefighters were able to get the western and southern edges of the fire under control, preventing it from crossing the 3.5 miles to the nearest residential area of Sterling. Alaska Division of Forestry Public Information Officer Celeste Prescott says firefighters are focusing on those two perimeters while coordinating with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to manage the fire for ecological benefits to the forest. Scientists have had a hard time monitoring Bogoslav volcano since it started erupting in December. Without on-site equipment on the Aleutian volcano, it's been difficult to predict eruptions. Alaska's Energy Desk's Zoe Sobel reports now scientists have set up some new equipment to bolster the monitoring network.
No one lives on Bogoslav. The closest human neighbors are 60 miles away in Unalaska. Because the island is so small, scientists don't have equipment on the volcano. They monitor it from afar, and they've had a lot to monitor lately. The volcano has erupted more than 40 times since December. Geophysicist John Lyon says there aren't many volcanoes like Bogoslav in the world, so he doesn't want to miss anything.
So the interesting thing about the eruption at Bogoslav is that it's erupting underwater, and then the eruption breaks the surface and goes into the atmosphere.
Lyons installed two hydrophones underwater near the island. They're essentially microphones that listen and record seismic waves during an eruption.
You know, right now we can only detect the most energetic activity from the volcano. And so hopefully with these two instruments that are much closer, we'll be able to detect and understand and study the eruption in much more detail.
Lyons says these recordings are unprecedented. Because the hydrophones are so close and in the water column, they're especially good at registering the low-level activity at Boguslav that the faraway monitoring network has missed. He'll have to wait a while to study them, though, since the hydrophones don't transmit their data. But there's another piece of equipment volcanologist Alexa Van Eaton has installed that will help right away. They track lightning, including volcanic lightning, which happens when static electricity builds up in ash clouds.
Unlike ground shaking and unlike acoustic energy, which can happen even when there's not a lot of ash getting to the atmosphere, lightning is unique to ash. And that's relevant because it's important for aviation hazards and communities like Dutch Harbor, which could be downwind.
The new sensors are part of a global lightning system called the Worldwide Lightning Location Network. The stronger network makes it easier to warn pilots that eruptions are underway, and it could help scientists understand if lightning at Boguslav means there's a lot of ash in the atmosphere and planes should avoid the area. For now, the scientists are relishing every bit of eruptive activity at Boguslav. The more it erupts, the more they can learn. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a push to reform the state's solitary confinement practices.
Segregation is known to be psychologically detrimental to those who are in there for any length of time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
One person is dead after being shot by Fairbanks police. Police spokeswoman Yumi McCulloch says the shooting happened at about 4 a.m. this morning when officers received two calls about a masked man wielding a rifle.
The man was located at an undisclosed location where officers, there were four FPD officers that were involved, and the gunman approached them and the officers fired and the gunman was died on the scene.
McCulloch says police have delayed releasing the location of the shooting because of safety concerns that prompted calling in a military explosive ordnance detection team.
The scene itself was secure from the public, but it did appear to have some hazards, and out of concern for the safety of the officers and the investigators there processing the scene, the Fort Wainwright EOD team was called out to assist.
McCulloch says the name of the suspect killed is being withheld pending notification of next of kin. The four officers involved are on administrative leave and their names will be released after 72 hours. It was the second officer-involved shooting in Fairbanks in a month. A former Kenai city manager died Sunday of injuries he sustained when he wrecked his motorcycle earlier that day on the Dalton Highway. Alaska state troopers say 60-year-old Ricky Cook was pronounced dead by medics who'd flown to Livengood. According to a trooper report posted this morning, Cook was riding with several friends when he lost control and wrecked at mile 39 near the Hess Creek Bridge, about 15 miles south of the Yukon River. Cook's friends brought him to Livengood, about 50 miles north of Fairbanks, where they were able to contact a resident by phone to call for help. Cook served as Kenai's city manager for 10 years until he left the office last year for an unsuccessful run at the legislature. Troopers say Cook was not wearing a helmet when he crashed. A trooper spokeswoman says an autopsy will be conducted in the near future. This was the second motorcycle-related death of a prominent Alaskan official in recent weeks. On June 11th, former Fairbanks District Attorney Michael Gray died after crashing his motorcycle in Canada while driving from Alaska to a family gathering in Montana. A bill transferring more than 19 acres of federal land in Sitka to the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SERCH, has passed preliminary committees in both the U.S. House and Senate. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
House Resolution 1901 was introduced by Congressman Don Young in April. A nearly identical version of the bill, S-825, was introduced into the U.S. Senate by Lisa Murkowski on the same day. The bill transfers lands currently owned by the Indian Health Service and gives them to SERCH at no cost. SERCH already occupies much of the land anyway and has been maintaining it for over two decades, according to CEO Chuck Clement. Clement testified in Washington, D.C. earlier this month before the House Subcommittee on Indian, Insular, and Native Affairs. He told House members that SERCH needed the land to replace Mount Edgecombe Hospital.
Our tertiary care hospital is located in Sitka, Alaska. It is the only hospital we operate. It was a hospital built by the Department of War approximately 70 years ago. As you can imagine, over the course of 70 years in Southeast Alaska, been very difficult on the facility, and there is a great need to update and upgrade and replace the facility. And given the current circumstances within the Indian Health Service with regards to replacement facilities in the Indian country, we've taken upon ourselves to work collaboratively with the IHS to figure out the best and most prudent way to go ahead and replace that facility.
The bill transfers the land under a so-called warranty deed, which guarantees SERCH full title and protects the organization against claims by other possible owners. A quitclaim deed would only transfer title with no guarantees. Congressman Don Young asked Clement on behalf of the IHS, which could not send staff to the hearing, why a warranty deed was so critical.
Something has to happen in Sitka. There has to be some level of development. And enable to coerce a financial partner, not coerce, to engage collaboratively with a financial partner, you know, whether it's the Alaska Bond Bank, whether it's a private financial institution, whether it's open bond markets, we are going to need to take loans on that land, and a quitclaim deed just will not cover that level of financial commitment that's going to be required.
I thank you for that answer, because that's the one thing we have transferred, I think, five other pieces of property under warranty deed for the same reason. I was just curious why they were saying it had limited aspects. So we will pass the bill with warranty deed with the help of the chairman and the ranking member, because you just want to build a new hospital. I've been in this hospital. By the way, SERCH does a great job with really old equipment. Not equipment, they got good equipment, just the buildings are 70 years old.
H.R. 1901 passed the House Subcommittee. A week later, S-825 was heard in the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs and also passed. Both bills will likely be heard in at least one other committee in the House and Senate before being combined into a single bill. As part of its expansion plan, SERCH has proposed buying out Sitka Community Hospital and converting it into a long-term care facility. All acute care in Sitka would move to Mount Edgecombe Hospital and then to its replacement if one is built. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Three Homer City Council members who were the subjects of a highly contentious recall effort will retain their seats. The political battle led to a court case with the American Civil Liberties Union, and two political groups have formed around the issue. Council members David Lewis, Katriona Reynolds, and Donna Adderhold all enjoyed double-digit wins as the official results came in on Friday. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has more.
As the canvas board tallied hundreds of absentee ballots Friday afternoon, several Heartbeat of Homer supporters in the audience eagerly awaited the results. The pro-recall political action committee's spokeswoman, Sarah Vance, sat quietly as the stacks of ballots were counted. The three council members narrowly eked out a win Tuesday in the regular vote and needed a strong showing from absentee voters. City Clerk Melissa Jacobson read the results for the record and those in attendance.
Question number one, shall Donna Adderhold be recalled from the office of Homer City Council? Yes, 825. No, 1,099.
Adderhold and Lewis were both favored by 57% of voters, and Reynolds came away with 56% of the vote. Vance and her supporters were noticeably disappointed as they walked out of City Hall.
Because we feel that they definitely were dishonest in their dealings over the issues, but the people have spoken, and we will proceed from here.
The three council members found themselves subjects of the recall effort this spring. Petitioners took issue with two resolutions they crafted and sponsored, namely an inclusivity resolution. Petitioners argue it was the council members' intent to make Homer a sanctuary city, damaging the tourism industry. They also claim their actions were misconduct in office. The council members all had one word for the results: vindicated. On Friday evening, Homer Citizens Against the Recall gathered in the very place the inclusivity resolution began, Homer resident Hal Spence's living room. Councilmember Reynolds gave an impromptu speech to supporters.
There hasn't been much that I could do about any of this for a long time, but knowing that you are all working to show that the recall was not valid, and I think we did that today with the results. We did it on Tuesday with the results.
Lewis and Reynolds both say they're happy the special election is over. However, Lewis notes the division created by the election will not dissipate overnight.
You know, I went back and read some of the articles, and we'd been called Marxists and all sorts of stuff, and that doesn't go away.
Adderhold, an avid writer and runner, adds she's excited to have time in her personal life. Homer Citizens Against the Recall chairman Ron Keffer explained the one-issue political action committee will be dissolved. But Keffer notes its progressively-minded supporters will remain a group.
Because we don't want to get ourselves into a position in which we have not been active enough and things happen and then we have to play catch-up. We want to be an active part constantly at this point.
The Homer City Council held a special meeting Monday to certify the results. However, all is not said and done. Heartbeat of Homer is seeking reimbursement for its legal fees from the council members. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Southeast offers the Finnish College Alaska initiative designed with flexible online learning options and customized degree programs. It's college that fits life, work, and play schedules while earning a degree. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August the 1st. Learn more at finishcollege.alaska.edu. This message is sponsored by UAS.
Two Anchorage men died and two were rescued when their fishing boat capsized near Seward on Saturday. Alaska State Troopers say the bodies of 53-year-old Benjamin Jimenez and 43-year-old Ferdinand Salvador were recovered. Seward troopers at about 3 p.m. on Saturday were notified by the Coast Guard that the private boat capsized just outside Resurrection Bay. The survivors were taken to the Seward Hospital. The Department of Corrections and the ACLU are working together to reform the department's solitary confinement practices. They brought in a team of experts from New York University to tour facilities and their segregation units last week and develop suggestions that will improve conditions for both inmates and staff. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman joined them at the Anchorage Correctional Complex.
Through heavy metal doors, down a plain white hallway is a plain white room lined with tiny two-person cells. Daylight seeps in through thin slits in the cell walls, falling on shiny metal toilets that are just feet from where the inmates sleep and eat. This is the punitive segregation unit at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. Inmates who live there have some access to phones, visiting hours, puzzle books, and other activities, but they're in their white cells for the vast majority of the day.
Segregation is known to be psychologically detrimental to those who are in there for any length of time.
That's Bruce Busby, DOC's Director of Institutions. A 2015 report from the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics showed just over 4% of all federal and state inmates nationwide were in restricted housing in 2012. Busby says in Alaska, it was closer to 10%.
The problem is it's really easy, and I'm going to call it lazy, right? An inmate does a bad thing, and we just throw them in seg. That's easy for us. It's hard on the individual.
But recently, the department has tried to reduce that number. It's currently at 8.5%. Busby says the department is looking for alternative ways to punish disciplinary problems whenever possible.
If you have an inmate who is always going to be bashing heads out in general pop, they have no business being in general pop. If it's an inmate who has a drug problem, maybe we can intercede in another way, you know, through treatment, through alternative sanctions.
That includes things like restricting access to commissary or requiring work service. Busby says many people also choose restricted housing because they fear for their safety in the general population. He says the department is looking at different housing options that make people feel safer.
So we want to house the goldfish with the goldfish and the sharks with the sharks.
And making prisons safer is one of the main goals of reforming segregation practices, according to Dan Pachoki, a researcher with New York University who was invited to Alaska by the DOC and the ACLU.
We want safe, humane environments. You can reduce segregation rates and create safer environments both for staff and offender at the same time.
Those are things Pachoki accomplished during his 33 years with the Washington State Corrections System. He says when walking through the Anchorage facility, he noticed that staff seemed thoughtful and inmates didn't shout as he passed by and greeted them, all positive indicators about conditions in the institution. The department is also learning from other institutions across the country to help inmates who are in segregation learn social skills and coping skills. Busby says they now have tables at the Spring Creek Correctional Center with handcuffs strung through them. That way, inmates can sit together and have group sessions without hurting each other. Some cells also have fenced-in porch-like areas that let them talk to people in the day room, but not physically interact. Other new innovations try to combat the effects of sensory deprivation. That's the sound of one of the new nature films offered at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. Soon, inmates from SEG will be able to sit alone in a secured, green-painted room with a giant flat-screen TV and immerse themselves in sounds and images of nature, everything from snow falling to flamingos playing. Other prisons in the U.S. have shown it reduces stress and anxiety and can de-escalate situations before they get violent. NYU researcher Sandy Mullins says that segregation doesn't exist in a vacuum, and over the next few months and years, they'll be looking at everything from Alaska's policies and procedures regarding entering and leaving segregation to what's influencing inmate behavior. Mullins says segregation is a tool for disrupting behavior, not an answer in and of itself. She says we need to remember that almost everyone who is incarcerated will at some point be released.
You want to do no harm. You don't want to create a person that's more broken than when they came in. And so while prison isn't inherently therapeutic, it can definitely be more humane, more of a generative environment where people are growing and thinking and being more ready to be on the outside.
The move toward reforming segregation in Alaska's prisons was prompted by the local ACLU, which was concerned about youth being placed in solitary when at adult facilities. The process will include interviews with prison staff and current and former inmates, and doesn't have a set timeline yet. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Henry Leisha in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.